This is what you want. This is what you get. This is what you want. This is what you get. This is what you want. This is what you get. This is what you want. This is what you get. This is what you want. This is what you get. This is what you want. This is what you get. This is what you want. This is what you get. This is what you want. This is what you get. This is what you want. This is what you get. This is what you want.
And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Bad news, girls. The good news is your dates are here.
What's the bad news?
They're dead.
Ah!
See, a United States astro robot becomes a creature of death.
And Dave.
We have come here to this planet for one purpose only, to acquire breeding stuff to repopulate our planet.
He who breaks the law shall be punished. Back to the house of pain. Back to the house of pain.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-movie podcast. From classic to cult and all the cheese in between, the movies might be B, but the entertainment is grade A. And I am your host, Mr. Jason Giaconetti. And I am joined once again by my dad, Mr. Al Giaconetti.
How's it going, Jay? I guess today we're going to do an oddball movie called Hardware. One thing I found when we do these podcasts, you get me to watch some movies that I haven't seen in years.
Yeah.
And Hardware is one of them.
Yep. And we'll get to it right after this.
The Earth died quickly after the Great War. The seas were deserts of radioactive dust. The skies choked by clouds of poison gas. But beyond the wastelands, a few survived to return to the cities, where deep in a matrix of flesh and metal, men discovered that a new enemy had been born. Now, in the 21st century, the experiment is out of control. Us Magazine gives it 3.5 stars and calls it as terrifying as Alien, as disturbing as 1984. WOR says the most thought-provoking film since A Clockwork Orange. And Fangoria Magazine calls it the best science fiction horror film of the year. Hardware. You can't stop progress.
Hardware was released September 14th, 1990 in the U.S. and October 5th, 1990 in Britain. It was directed by Richard Stanley, produced by Joanne Seller and Paul Tryzbit. It was also written by Richard Stanley. Richard Stanley is a name some of you might recognize. He did a movie called Dust Devil, and he actually was the original director on Island of Dr. Moreau before they ran him off, and there's all that documentary about him trying to sneak back on set and all the craziness that went on there. It's based on Shock, S-H-O-K with an exclamation point, which is part of the 2000, what is it called? I can't It was part of the 2000 AD comic strip, excuse me. And that was by Steve McManus and Kevin O'Neill. And originally, the idea was taken from that, and they weren't given credit. But later on, credit was given to them because the story's pretty close exactly what they did. Music by Simon Boswell. Now, that's a name that some of you might know, especially in the 90s and stuff. That's a name that came up as a composer. This is a British film. So the production company was the British Satellite Broadcasting and the British Screen Unlimited Palace Productions. It was distributed by Phase UK in the UK and Miramax here in the US. It had a running time of 94 minutes, a budget of $1.5 million, and a box office just over $5.7 million, which means, yes, folks, B-movies, this is a little movie. And we talked about this at the end of the last episode, the episode of Fly. This is a movie that was highly, highly controversial at the time and was cut. And a lot of that had to do with the gore and stuff like that. We'll talk about that as we get there, but most people know this movie simply because they remember it being a movie that was hard to find because it was so cut up. The movie stars Dylan McDermott as Mo Baxter, and he is one of the Americans in this. And then Stacey Travis plays Jill. She's the other American in the movie. John Lynch plays Shades. Some of you might recognize him from his work later on. But the names, the people that people actually recognize, Iggy Pop is Angry Bob on the radio. Lemmy is the taxi driver in it. And then Carl McCoy plays Nomad. William Hookins, Mark Northover, and Paul McKenzie. And those are some of the other people named, a lot of British names in there because of different rules. And we'll talk about that as we go. So our story opens as a nomad scavenger treks through an irradiated wasteland and discovers a buried robot. He collects the pieces and takes them to a junk dealer, Alvy, who is talking with Mo Baxter, a former soldier, and Mo's friend, Shades. When Alvy steps away, Mo buys the robot parts from the nomad and sells all but the head to Alvy. Now, the funny part is the nomad guy is... I forgot the band. He's the lead singer from another band.
Yeah, it's Motorhead.
No, that's Lemmy. Lemmy's like... No, this is...
Oh, Ministry?
No. I don't remember off the top of my head his name, but he was a lead singer from another band who had actually, Richard Stanley had done the music video for them.
Oh.
And that's why there's so many music ties. And Richard Stanley has a lot of his ties in the music world, which is why he's got Iggy Pop and Lemmy. And the soundtrack for this movie is actually one of the things that it's known for as well. So where are we? So intrigued by the technology, Alvy begins to research its background. Mo and Shades visit Jill, Mo's reclusive girlfriend, and after an initial distant welcome where Jill checks them with a Geiger counter, Mo presents the robot head as a Christmas gift. Jill, who is a metal sculptor, eagerly accepts the head. After Shades leaves, Mo and Jill argue about government sterilization program and the mortality of having children, and then later is the sex scene, which we'll talk, not about it itself, but what the controversy, some of the stuff that was in there that was cut, while being unknowingly watched by a foul-mouthed, perverted, voyeuristic neighbor, Lincoln Weisberg, via a telescope, which is one of the, again, the issues people have with this. Jill works the robot head into the sculpture after she paints it with the American flag, which is very iconic. That head, the shot of the Mark 13, which is what the robot is, painted with the American flag on it, while it's not the cover of the special edition DVD, it was on the cover of a lot of the stuff that came promotional-wise from it. The head doesn't have the actual imagery on it of the American flag. That actually was used a lot in other things. That image was taken and used a lot in a lot of stuff that I shouldn't say steampunk, because steampunk's the wrong thing, but a lot of that kind of disenfranchised, dystopia, end of the world stuff. That image has been used over and over again, or somehow taken and changed a little. But the idea of having the stars on one side and the bars on the other really became an image that was used over and over again. Again, and 2000 AD, the comic book, that's where Judge Dredd come from. The horrible movie with Sylvester Stallone and the really good movie with Carl Urban, notwithstanding, that's where that stuff comes from. And if you're a 20 AD fan, that imagery of that stuff all comes from in there. And that's why they took a lot of stuff from Shock. So where are we? So she works the head into the sculpture. Mo says that he likes the work, but he does not understand what it represents. Frustrated, Jill says it represents nothing and resents Mo's suggestion that she make more commercial art to sell. And because she's living on welfare, he's a soldier, And what does he say? They take a big cut of my paycheck every month. Where do you think that money comes from? It's a lot of stuff going on here below just like guy, girl, you know, whatever stuff. There's deeper stuff because he works, he's a soldier, and he does whatever soldiering things he has to do and killing people. And clearly, you know, they're living in a world that's been irradiated, and you know, the temperature is 130 degrees and stuff like that. And she's looking at it like, I don't want to do any of that stuff. She kind of tries to shelter herself in, which is funny because she's trying to be completely sheltered and closed off, and yet right around her there's death and killing and all this stuff that goes on, and they're talking about in the radio, which is what Iggy Pop's used for, Angry right. Bob there, the sterilization program and how they're going to sterilize people, and if you have too many kids they're going to take away your food rations. And it's just a lot of like just stuff that wasn't touched on a lot in movies, at least not at this point, that aspect of things. So they're interrupted by Alvy, who urges Mo to return to the shop as he's important news about the robot, which he says is a Mark 13. And Mark 13 actually plays the over here. Before he leaves, Mo checks his Bible, which actually Dylan McDermott did all that in his own. He actually wanted, it was not in the script. He put that in about having Mark chapter 13. Now, they put some fake lines in the Bible at that point because they needed to fit the story. But that was all Dylan McDermott thinking, this would be good. Let's tie this in. So he checks the Bible and finds the fake. No flesh shall be spared, which is under Mark 13:20. And he becomes suspicious that the robot is part of a government plot for the human genocide. Mo finds Alvy dead of a cytotoxin and evidence that the robot is an experimental combat model capable of self-repair, which I think is, again, you kind of look at that, the idea of like it pulling itself back together. And we see that in the apartment as it starts, you know, pulling all the wires together and making itself and draining the power. And, you know, so Alvy's notes also indicate a defect, a weakness to humidity. Worried, Mo contacts Shades and asks him to check on Jill, but Shades in the middle of a drug trip and is barely coherent. I mean, it is a bad trip he's on. He's all like, I love he falls face first, right? Mm. He falls in the pillow, but he just falls face first. Back at the apartment, the robot has reassembled itself using pieces of Jill's metal structure and recharged by draining her apartment's power network. It attempts to kill Jill, but she traps it in a room after her the apartment doors lock. Lincoln sees the robot close the blinds while trying to peep on Jill, and after he briefly manages to open the apartment door and starts harassing her, offers to override the emergency lock that traps them in the apartment. Now, I think that's part of it, too. Lincoln is the most despicable character in the entire thing, and you're just not supposed to like him. He's just gross. Right. He's fat. He's disgusting. He's just there's nothing. There's no redeeming quality to him at all. So anybody who's seeing this is like, well, he better die because he's just a piece of crap. And he's so disgusting. And like even saying like, well, you made me a cup of tea and this. And she's just so like trusting because she knows there's a killer robot there. But you're like, you can't trust this guy. Lincoln dismisses her warnings about a killer robot. And then when he attempts to open Jill's blinds so that he can more easily peep on her. Again, he's trying to open the... He's only trying to get the blinds open. The Mark 13 kills him. Now, he says, "It's how can you see Santa Claus? Because it's Christmas." This is the crazy part about this. It's 130 degrees. This all takes place on Christmas. And that comes to play later with the Chinese or the Chinese family that lives below them.
Ooh.
Yeah. So Mark 13 brutally kills him. And that's one of the things that was cut. A lot of that was cut down. That's where that comes in. She flees to the kitchen where she reasons that the refrigerator will be able to hide her from the robot's infrared vision. She damages the robot before Mo, Shades, and the apartment security team arrive and open fire, apparently destroying it. So when she gets in the fridge, the scene I always love in there, she turns the dial away and it really turns it cold, and it's trying to grab her breath. Her breath is making the little steam, and he's trying to grab it, and it keeps trying to grab it. That's such a great little, that most people probably don't even think about. But it's such a great little scene that shows like they were thinking about, there's got to be, why is she in the fridge? Like, doesn't make, but she makes it so cold in that fridge, and it's like trying to find where the vent is. It hears it and it's looking. It's like, remember in Neil Marshall's the Descent, when the crawlers are and it can't see her and it's trying to smell her, but she's in all the blood and the feces and she's just sitting in it and it's right in her face and it can't smell her. Or even better, it's Predator. I mean, yes, that's what it's doing. It's Predator, and where he can't see him because of the mud.
Right.
But to me, it's like the Predator doesn't go right up to his face. He You know, like, it is almost touching her. Like, it scans and it can't see Schwarzenegger. Right.
Yeah, because there's no heat signal.
There's no heat signal. But then it's grabbing at the heat signal. But I'm thinking more in the descent when it's like smelling her. Right. And, like, she's covered herself. So, anyway. As Jill and Mo embrace, the Mark 13 drags her out the window. And she crashes into her neighbor's apartment, which is what the dinner the Chinese family is having. Jill races back upstairs to help Mo, who is alone with the Mark 13. Overconfident, Mo engages the robot in a battle. And it injects him with the same toxin that killed Albie. Now, the funny part about the toxin it's using, it comes out of the two needles it has coming down from its mouth. That clearly looked like a vampire. That's the whole what they're going for. That it's like a venomous snake, right? Albie says it gives you a euphoric state, and it smells like apple pie. Like, it's just these weird things. You're like, right. What? But then again, you know, we know now, again, living in a world, and this is 1990, we're living in a world that's much, much different now. You know, if you smell almonds and things like that, we all know that those are poisons, and those are things like, you know, certain poisons have certain smells and things like that. So, he injects him at the same toxin. So Mo experiences euphoria, and that's where probably the weirdest stuff in the movie happens. He starts hallucinating. It's very like Lawnmower Man kind of weird crap happening there. After he dies, Jill re-enters the apartment. The Mark 13 sets her apartment doors to rapidly open close, like the weirdest set of like chompy teeth, which I thought was funny. Security team dies when they attempt to enter, and then Shade is trapped outside. Now that's when the guy gets chopped in half of the door, and when it hits him, it shoots the gun and it shoots the younger one in the head. Jill hacks into the Mark 13 CPU and unsuccessfully attempts to communicate with it. However, she discovers the robot's weakness and lures the Mark 13 into the bathroom. Shades, who managed to quickly time and jump through the door, like any good, you know, video game player would do, gives her time, comes in, he puts the gun right to the thing, but he doesn't pull the trigger. And I think that's, Shades is always a very damaged character. He's a drug addict and everything else is wrong with him. But it gives her a chance to turn on the water, the shower. The Mark 13 short circuits and is finally deactivated, and that's when she's beating on it with the bat. And it's funny, because that bat is a real bat. She's really beating on it. It really breaks, and they kept filming because it looks so good that the bat breaks, and she's swinging with that piece of broken bat coming down. The next morning on the radio, broadcast announced that the Mark 13 has been approved by the government and is in mass production.
Right. Like I said, this is a movie I had not seen in a long, long time. As I'm watching this, I thought that there was a huge number of elements from Mad Max,
sure.
Soylent Green,
oh yeah,
Blade Runner, Predator, but mostly Terminator, especially as it at the end, you know, when the
the influences that have been said to be included here, and they're not making any bones about the fact they took thing yeah. was Soylent Green, of course, Damnation Alley, and of Philip K. Dick. A lot of his stuff is in there. Movies they take from other things, and they were inspired by those things, you know, kind of thing. Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, of course, the Terminator is easy to see. Predator's easy to see, and then some of those scenes.
Yeah, I mean, it just so happens that all the movies that we just mentioned were on screen before this movie was made.
Yeah,
and I mean, the end of the movie to me there was a lot of gratuitous deaths. That the door closes and it squishes the guy. That was one of the more you know, ugly scenes that they actually were able to keep in the movie from what we gather.
Yeah.
That there was a lot more that made it to the cutting room floor. But again, as I'm watching this movie, I found it was also very dark. Now, and I think I mentioned this when we were talking about The Fly, that the set decorator in The Fly did a really great job with the lab scene. Whoever was the set decorator here did another great job, because what you can see is a compendium of computers wires and the junk that the gal uses to build her trinkets to sell on the street, and so he's got to be the star of the movie. But the robot itself, I mean, and to some extent, it looked like WALL-E. To me.
Well, but okay, this is...
No, I know.
But the head is more or less known about. Because when he talked about what the Mark 13 looks like, it has six legs, it has whatever, but it's building itself back from the junk it finds. The head is the most iconic thing that it has. And that when she paints it with the American flag, you know, that actually, again, there's a lot of things. This is a British movie that was shot with American actors, and that's why there's actually Dylan McDermott and Stacey Travis were the only two Americans in the movie, because what happened was originally Richard Stanley wanted Bill Paxton to play Moe, and he wanted Jeffrey Combs to play Shades, but he already had Tracy Travis signed on. But Miramax kind of balked at Paxton. They were like, we don't know about Bill Paxton. Now, this was a dumb on their part, because Bill Paxton has been in the... His movies, he's not the reason why, but he's been in the movies that make the most money.
He's the good luck charm.
Yeah, because let's face it, Titanic. Yeah, you can say what you want about DiCaprio, whatever. Bill Paxton's in it. It makes a lot of money. Twister, you name it.
Aliens.
Yeah, right. What I'm saying, but what happened was Paxton then went on and signed on to be in Navy SEALs, which helped him break out with Michael Biehn and guys that he had been with. And Combs couldn't be cast because you're only allowed to have two American actors in a movie due to the British Union laws.
Really?
Right, yeah. Well, at least at the time, that's what it was. And that's why Jeffrey Combs doesn't play it. Now, the guy who plays Shades kind of plays, you know, a drug addict. Well, I don't know if Jeffrey Combs would be the guy I would want playing there. Jeffrey Combs, for those of you who aren't sure, Reanimator. He's, you know, Dr. Herbert West from all the Reanimator movies. But... You know, part of what happens is the robot itself is being rebuilding itself and putting itself back together. I don't remember a robot that was like in that way. That's not used often, where it builds itself back. It will sometimes build a creature, but I don't think it builds itself back. It reminds me, kind of like, remember in Monster Squad when they blow up the Wolfman?
Right.
And you can't kill a Wolfman by that, so he pulls himself back together. Like, everyone's like, what? And it's like, okay, but you're willing to buy all this stuff? Like,
well, yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah. Like, in the Terminator, where when he blows up and
he melts and comes back together. That's 1992, though. That's
no,
after
I, no, I realize that. But again, it's that when you're watching a movie like this, even though it predates something that happens. Your mind says, I've got this all this knowledge.
Yeah.
And I'm saying, you know, then you have to go back and you look at it. That's why I said the ones that I mentioned, like the Mad Max, the Terminator, Blade Runner, dated this movie. And whether it was intentional or not intentional, as I'm watching the movie, I found it to be, as I said, I didn't enjoy it as much as I thought I would. Because I'm saying, well, they got that from there and they got that from there. So the doubts that were raised in my mind led me to not enjoy the movie as much as I thought I would. And I found myself trying to come up with reasons for liking it. And so what did I do? I said, well, the set decorations were pretty good. But then again, even on the kills, we've seen a lot better kills than this. But some of them were just what it does to the pervert. Is incredible.
Rips them apart. Well, the problem is this: is that this movie originally, and this is what we're talking about, controversy. This movie was rated X originally, and again, an X rating in 1990 meant that you were making pornography, and this movie is not pornography. There is a sex scene in the movie, but it is tastefully shot. You don't see much. I mean,
you see it like through the eyes of Predator. You see it.
Well, you see it through the machine.
You also see it through
Lincoln watching through the telescope.
Right.
But it's not like you're watching a porno. You're certainly not watching Debbie Does Dallas. You're watching a love scene or a sex scene in a movie that was shot more tastefully. Now that what the controversy in that scene is, and that was what cut, and that's in the special features, is on the TV, because her TV is on. What they're showing is concentration camps, and they're showing people getting killed. And the whole point is they're there partaking in this, you know, this lovemaking session. And what's on the TV? But it's people getting killed, and it's all the emaciated bodies and the stuff that look like concentration camps. Richard Stanley actually had made a post-apocalyptic short film when he was a teenager, and Hardware grew out of this. And it was his response that he got from that in an unproduced script that he had actually done. He had joined a guerrilla Muslim faction in the Soviet war in Afghanistan and shot a documentary. So he's showing you what he was looking at through his camera, the starvation and the death and the concentration camp stuff. That's all there. When she turns the TV on and she has the music video comes on, right? The first thing that's on there is it's a concentration camp where Jewish people were being executed. It is World War II film, and it's real film, and he purposely put that in there. And she changes the channel. She puts on what turns out to be a gore video, Gwar is a band that wears a lot of makeup and crazy stuff. I know you know who they are, but Gwar is definitely weird. But it's a ministry song playing, and that's one of the things this movie's famous for. The music in this movie, the order of death, which is the song, this is what you get, this is what you want, this right. is what you get, right? That's Public Image Limited. And that is one of their most famous songs, at least to me. I mean, again, there might be huge fans of them going, you don't know anything. To me, that's the song that I've always known them for, and that's a great song. But what's in there, Iggy Pop sings Bad Life. He sings Cold Metal. I mean, he's, Iggy, and again, I'm not an Iggy Pop fan, but Iggy Pop is a very big artist. And the song that I knew from there, I mean, obviously, you're the two. Ace of Spades by Motorhead. And that's like, Ace of Spades, and it's going. Like, I mean, and again, Motorhead, I mean, Lemmy, who has since passed away recently, Motorhead is big. Motorhead became Triple H's song. The King of Kings.
Oh, okay.
That's Motorhead.
Oh, okay.
Motorhead's no joke. Motorhead is a serious band. And then the other band, a group that Luke and I really liked a lot, and they make different stuff, is Ministry. Ministry made Psalm 69, The Way to Succeed and The Way to Suck Eggs. That was one of their major albums. No, when we bought it, you were like, what is this we're listening to? But they sing, it's metal, but it's like sped up, and it's that industrial sound that was so 1990s. To me, this movie always reminds me of The Crow. And not because of the story, because of the music. In The Crow, the music is so important to that movie. And here, while the music's not as, like, because he's not a musician, the music is so important to what's there. When Ace of Spades is playing, you hear that beat, that industrial grunge, like, not grunge as in Seattle grunge, Soundgarden and Alice in Chains and Nirvana stuff, but that like, industrial, this dirty and grimy future, which I think the Mad Max films don't embrace as much. Mad Max is shot in broad daylight and it's out there and stuff, but Mad Max is very dystopian, and I'm not saying it's pleasant, but I think what we saw in Mad Max, and then of course the Road Warrior is to me the better of the original trilogy. That's the best of the movies. Mad Max is a good movie, but Road Warrior is really good, but there's not that, there's a little difference. What we saw then later in Mad Max Fury Road, think about that. The guitar player with the fire. When he's... That drumming, when they're coming for them, that whole movie just never stops. And you're like, okay. And it gives you a chance to catch your breath. You're like, okay, we're back. And we're just keep going. I think that's what Richard Stanley was trying to get here. His issue was he was limited by his budget, too. He didn't have a lot of money.
Yeah.
The original scene, that storm scene where that was shot in Morocco. And they happened to catch a real storm. That storm could not have produced for $1.5 million budget. They couldn't produce that in a studio. It would look like some crap. It would look like some old video game crap, it would look like. But they were able to capture that, and then what happened was the rest of the movie was shot in East London. And that was because it was a British production, but Miramax was the parent company. That's the Weinstein brothers.
Right.
Right? And they're here, and they insisted on American leads, and that became a problem because American leads cost money, and you could only have two, and I had to bring guys over. Like, Dylan McDermott's not a name to carry something.
No, he was in The Practice.
Yeah, right. So Dylan McDermott, I'm like, okay, she goes, I don't want to, no, she thinks he's good looking, but again, a lot of women think he's good looking, right? But, Tracy Travis, she's from Ghost World, but it doesn't mean that like those movies, that TV series and movies were carrying this, because it's all that happened after these.
I mean, that's why when I saw who was in the movie, I said, I know his face. Where's he from? And then you realize it's The Practice. But other than that,
Right. What I'm saying is, but what happened was Richard Stanley's issue was Miramax wanted this to be much more marketable in an American audience, right? So they wanted American leads, which meant that his $1.5 million went far less being able to go further. If you had British leads in it, you could pay them, not say pay them less, but you didn't have to bring them over. They're in London already, right? So what happens is Stanley wanted, he tried to add the cast to be different. He tried to make, like, he had, clearly they weren't just British African Americans. He's trying to make different, he's trying to muddy the water up a little bit to make the cast look a little more diverse, because he wanted to emphasize the ideas of fascism and passive acceptance of authoritarianism that was going on. Remember, I mean, at that point, he had recently, a lot of that stuff, apartheid in this is 1990. Apartheid, that was the regime in South Africa. That's what he's making a comment about. This movie is layers. It's like an onion. You got to peel back a layer to see something, right? On the surface, this appears to be a sci-fi movie. There's a lady, she fights a robot, she kills it, blah, blah, whatever. But all the different things, his acceptance, when Mo said, well, I think it's a good idea that they're going to sterilize people. And she's like so against it. But he's like, wait, you want to have kids? He goes, well, we're not going to have kids. Like, there's that back and forth. He's given up the idea that they're ever having children. She's like, well, we could have kids. He's like, you want to have kids? No. Like, okay, but like, then why are you fighting this? Like, you're, you know, that, that it's just those ideas. And I think that's really what the movie speaks to. And I think that's why it was edited so much. They were afraid that if they put a movie out with these themes in it, it's not a problem. There are a lot of, 1984 comes to mind, both versions of it, you know, things like that. Plenty of movies like that. But then they took the violence, and this is something that McTierney said about Predator. The scene where they open fire on the Predator in the jungle,
yeah,
and people say, well, that's overkill. He goes, exactly. He goes, it has to be overkill. He goes, I have to go so over the top to get my point across to you that you just, you're like, all right, fine. And they hit nothing, quote unquote, right? And they do. They don't kill the Predator. And it's like, why? He's like, because I have to be over the top. The kills in this movie, as they originally were, when Lincoln is murdered, because Lincoln gets like slaughtered. I mean, blood goes everywhere. There's that going on. Then you have the death when the doors chomp on the security guard. I mean, they still show some of it, and it's been restored as much as they can, but I don't even have the footage. This movie should have run probably another 5 minutes longer.
Well, I think it probably should have been even longer than that.
Yeah, but at least there's at least 5 more minutes of gore that we're not seeing. Alvy's death is off screen. Like, these things all occur, and you're like, okay, but we see way worse than this. In 1990, if you released a movie unrated, no one saw it. No one saw an unrated movie in 1990. Because where was it playing? It wasn't playing at a movie theater. Because movies weren't allowed to be unrated and still play at a movie theater. When you release a movie and it's unrated, no movie theater in their right mind would have carried it. And what happens? It's slapped with an X rating. Well, X rating means it's porn and it's playing on 42nd Street,
yeah,
along with whatever, piece of crap they filmed in 8 minutes with Ron Jeremy in it, right? And that's the problem is, this movie has that aspect to it. It has a political statement underneath it that is not popular because most of the world did not want to think about apartheid or the concentration camps. And no one wants to talk about that stuff, especially in the early 90s. It's not like now when everyone's feelings mean something. It's the 90s. People didn't want to talk about that stuff. Put all that blood in there. You put the idea that, like, when he's, you know, that's why that scene where he's injected and he sees the hallucinations is so crazy. It's so different, right? He starts cutting his arm up.
Right.
You had mentioned to me, like, well, why is he cutting his arm up? And originally, when I saw this movie, I had to buy a bootleg on from tape to DVD bootleg of this to get anything beyond so we could actually see it, because it was never available. And you can never tell what's in his hands. It's like blood. When you look at it now, it's still blood, but he's cutting himself up, and you're like, what is going on? But it's the idea of the body horror there. If this was a Cronenberg movie, people are like, oh, yes, body horror, but it's body. But it's Richard Stanley, and his movies are weird. Dust Devil is weird, right? You know, his version of Island of Dr. Moreau, if it had ever been finished, would have been really weird. And that's what he makes. So, just want to throw this out there. It says, this movie was actually an unsuspected success, but it was caught up in a lot of legal issues preventing the DVD for many years, right? And this is what we were talking about.
Right.
It was released on a Region 2 DVD and Blu-ray back in 2009, and then in October of 2009, Severin Films put out this. It was the 25-year anniversary. They were, not 29-year, whatever it was, they were fighting and fighting and fighting to get this movie out, and it just wasn't allowed because it was all tied up in different things. So what happened was, when this movie debuted in America, it debuted at number 6. The opening week, it was number 6, and it made just under $2.4 million in opening weekend, right? For a total, it only played in 695 theaters and it made just over $5.7 million. Its opening weekend, it made almost $2.4 million.
Right.
That's crazy. For the movie with no star, Dylan McDermott's not a star. You know, there's no name on it. It's not a Schwarzenegger. It's not a Clint Eastwood. It's nothing like that, right? It was a movie that looked different. People went and saw it. Now, again, a lot of people are writing to go back and see it a second time, and a lot of people passed on it. But to open at number 6 with a movie that, on this small a budget...
Okay. What you had mentioned, when did it open in the United States?
It opened in the United States. It actually opened September 14th.
Yeah, so it's after the summer.
It's after, of course, it's after summer. Yeah. And they didn't hold it for Halloween. Because this is not a Halloween movie. Kind of thing. It's not that. And I think sometimes people think, oh, it's going to be gross or whatever.
But the thing is, like, September is a slow month for movies. I mean, if you get into August, those are the movies that either didn't get the prime weekend in June and July, or you said, okay, there's nothing playing, maybe we can recoup some of our bucks.
Right. Well, but you know, to dump it in September, though, that's also when you dump movies. Movies are dumped in September and February for a reason. Not nowadays. Nowadays, movies can hit whenever they want, and they're always going to be big or not big. The problem was, you dump a movie in September. Kids are going back to school. Kids are back at college. People are kind of like getting back from the summer, getting back in the swing of doing the year. It's a movie that's dumped. I got it, it's dumped. And I don't know what the other top movies in that week were in 1990. I mean, it could be, you know, some romantic comedy or whatever. Those movies always make their money because they have a built-in audience. But I think this movie is one of those things that it's been lost for so long because the legal battle to get it out was just so much there. And Stanley himself has been, you know, what you might think of him as a director or a writer or anything else, he's run into a lot of controversy in his life.
You know, now this movie, you said it came, it was on, the DVD was released in
2009.
I mean, we're now almost eight, nine years later.
Yeah, yeah.
I wonder if there could be a special edition of this.
Well, this is probably the most special edition they're going to have. I don't think they have any more. I looked around to see if there was anything out there. It appears that everything they have was put into this one disc.
Okay.
Because they got this released, and Severin worked really hard. Severin Films puts out movies that most people wouldn't either want to touch or are not interested in touching. I'm thinking, they just released this year, what's it called? Wild Beast, which is a movie it is a weird movie, folks. It is, it's all shot in Germany at the zoo. It's about them putting, I think, PCP in the water or something in the water, and it drives all the animals crazy. But there's real animals, and they have like a polar bear. Like, he's not attacking the kids, but there's real kids and a real polar bear, and they're in the same room. It's not like there's a polar bear, and we pan over the other side, and it's there. You know, it's like they touch movies that no one wants to. They touch a lot of that exploitation movies that have a lot of nudity and stuff in them that people just don't want to like dirty their hands with. And I think that's why they were the people to put this out, because this is a movie. I mean, again, whether you like this movie or not, there are a lot of people I know who love this movie. This is a movie like, wow, Hardware, such a good movie. And maybe some of that is because of when they saw it. Maybe they saw it back in the early 90s. Maybe they got their hands on a bootleg DVD of it, or the original tape. There was a tape of it that came out. And it was one of those things that was passed around and passed around and passed around. And those movies sometimes hold a place, a special place with you because of their rarity, of because what it is. Or maybe in 1990 it spoke to you. Maybe you were, in college and you were worried about the apartheid and all that other stuff. And this is a movie saying those things. Who knows?
Yeah, I like the movie.
Yeah.
I personally, just to give you an example. I'm a fan of the original Blade Runner with the voiceover. If there had been any kind of a voiceover here and would have helped explain some of the progression in the movie, I think I might have enjoyed it even more, because I found, as I said, my thinking was, because I know so much of what comes later and of the ones just previous to this, that I found the movie being very, it was almost like a copycat. And that's not what it is. I mean, all the points you just made. I mean, there's no, like Blade Runner. Blade Runner doesn't have any.
Well, there's a lot of stuff going on in Blade Runner.
Yeah, but I mean, but not.
Not apartheid.
Not apartheid.
No, that's talking about. That's a whole nother. That's a whole nother. Well, no, it's a whole nother movie.
But I'm saying,
the Philip K. Dick stuff that they reference here is exactly what you're talking about. The idea of, to me, Blade Runner is like. What was that, the old thing? Remember they talked about Alien? It was like blue collar space. Like, it was like the blue collar workers.
Right.
It was grungy and dirty. And then like Star Wars was not. Like, it was all like, you know, kind of whatever. Like, there was different kinds. Like, or 2001 was all very bright, whatever. And Star Wars had some of that too. That blue collar, that kind of grimy thing. I think some of the imagery here, when in the streets, that reminds me a lot of Blade Runner. The griminess of the streets, the dirtiness. Like when Harrison Ford's walking. In the street, and you're like, oh, it's just so dirty. You feel dirty.
That part reminded me of Soylent Green.
Because
it's bright. The one thing about Blade Runner is that it is dark the entire time.
I'm saying, but when they're going into the building, and he's like, this used to be a respectable building, and it's all like these guys chopping up meat, and it's all that stuff that Blade Runner has in it. And it's kind of that dirty, grungy kind of feel.
Yeah.
Oh, no, it's the Soylent Green stuff. I mean, that's like.
it almost so it's almost meta in this movie kind of thing. I mean, the sterilization and the whole. Like, I mean, that is the as Soylent Green, and again, another movie. I think we talked about it with The Fly. The Fly was able to put iconic imagery forward. Soylent Green, even if you've never seen Soylent Green, right? Everyone knows Soylent Green is people, right? You know, kind of thing, and that they know that, but they're like, well, how do I know that? I've never seen them,
right? Well, right? Yeah.
Because it's so ingrained in the sci-fi process. So I think sometimes you have to hit things that people know to get them to come. Oh, okay. Because especially when you're making, he was making political statements. This is a political statement movie, kind of behind the robot. I myself like the robot. I think he looks cool. I like that it comes together. Yes, it is a little derivative at times. The eyes, especially. I think the eyes are the most derivative thing of Terminator. The red eye.
Yeah, the red eye.
And I mean, it's so derivative of the Terminator. But I think also too, by making it not human, not a humanoid, by making it more like a spider, you kind of took a little away from that. You know, kind of, instead of like, oh, look, it's just a, you know, T-800, you know.
Well, I tell you the truth. Towards the end, when she turns on the water and it short circuits the electronics, I said to myself, if his eyes go out, that's it for me.
Yeah, well, it has to go out. But that scene also too, when he smashes through and is grabbing at her.
Oh yeah.
That's when the trailer. And again, that imagery is used other places. But what this movie's known besides the head and the face, the scene in the shower when Dylan McDermott and her are taking the shower together, and his metal hand is going down her body.
Yeah.
That imagery has been stolen and used over and over and over again in a lot of different things, right? What good and bad.
Yeah.
And I think that too speaks to this movie too. If you're going to steal from a movie, it had to say something to you. This movie makes political statements, yes.
Yeah.
But I think sometimes the way things are shot, there's a lot of steam and smoke in this because he's ripping all the wires out. Could this have been shot just like, you know, oh, we can see everything, you know?
Well, I don't mind not seeing everything.
But what I'm saying is, I think that gives it that aspect.
Oh, no, it does,
So you have to, as the old ECW saying would be, accentuate the positives and hide the negatives. They didn't have a ton of money. Originally, Richard Stanley, I'm not kidding, he said, I want to shoot this with stop motion animation.
Yeah.
Right? And they said, are you crazy? Do you know how much that's going to cost? He goes, no, this creature would be amazing in stop motion. And it would have been.
Yeah.
Right? So what happens is they can't do it. The budget is smaller. So they have to now, so you pump a little steam in. It's the same way in, and Aliens is an amazing movie. But in Aliens, they use the steam to help kind of hide with the aliens so they can come out. What he's trying to do here, and again, I'm not saying it's not, the idea is not taken from somewhere, but she's in the kitchen and she's looking, and what happens? The stove is on and it's bright red. You notice the stove look kind of like an interocitor?
Yes.
Right? And I'm kind of, I think, you guys building an interocitor up there? No! It's an interocitor, and everything's boiling, and it's like he's trying to turn things off and nothing works. That as it's coming forward, you see it emerge from the. And it's a very classic.
Right. Yes.
The queen comes out of that stuff and whatever, you know. But again, I don't think Richard Stanley was going out. I think he knew that the movie he was making was never going to be, you know, the biggest budgeted movie ever because he had to be a very limited thing was there.
Yeah, but the thing with the movie is that his themes in the movie were not very popular, so you weren't going to get. 20th Century Fox or Universal. No,
that's why Miramax picked it up.
Yeah. Now,
the Weinstein brothers are not afraid of taking chances.
Right. I mean, that's what I was going to say. When I saw the Weinstein brothers as executive producers, that's when I said, well, I understand where this movie's going to be going to. What I found at the end that I thought was it referenced something else was how does the robot die? Something as simple as running water.
Right.
And you know what it brought back to me? The original War of the Worlds.
Yeah.
They can't kill these things for nothing, but
the common cold
is what stops them.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the more you overthink how to kill something, the easier sometimes it is.
Yeah. So actually, Richard Stanley wrote a sequel to the film called Hardware 2, Ground Zero, and tried to get that off the ground for a few years, but he was the problem was the rights were so split up between. Miramax and Paul Tribbets and whatever people own the rights and wouldn't come together. So his sequel though would have been different because he wanted to make it closer to a Western and shoot it in a much larger scale, right? And then obviously, you know, things got stalled out and he moved on to other projects. he definitely was trying to, and knowing that his other movie that maybe people know is Dust Devil, which is a Western, Western themed. It definitely, you can see what's going on. But Paul, he's not, Richard, not Paul Stanley. Paul Stanley is in Kiss.
Right.
Richard Stanley, he's not a director. You're going to be like, whoa, you know, it's not like when you see Tony Scott or Ridley Scott, of course, but like Tony Scott's name in a movie. Like, you see that, and I'm like, okay, Tony Scott, like, I got to see, because he doesn't make bad movies, you know, kind of thing. Like, whether you like Man on Fire and things like that, Tony Scott movies are like, okay.
Yeah, they move.
And there's him to him, because he makes that kind of movie. I think Stanley makes his type of movie, and he understands that his movies might not appeal to everybody. But again, if you want to make popcorn movies, make popcorn movies.
Right.
Right? I mean, that's what the guy who plays Iron Man...
It's a senior moment, as
Tony Stark would say, you know. What does he always say?
Downey Jr.
Robert Downey Jr. Yeah, I see what he says. He goes, their movie make people about make movies about art. I make movies that make lots of money. I make lots of money, and that's what it's about. And there's people who make those movies. And I don't know. I don't think that was necessarily what he was looking to do here. It did make this was considered a big success. If you're talking about $1.5 million as your budget, and you made $2.4 your opening weekend, and then made $5.7, that's only in the U.S. Europe, it made a ton of money because they love that stuff.
Yeah.
And it speaks more to a different kind of thing. In America, it's hard. 1990s, we're talking about what? We're at Reagan's second term is over. We're in the middle of George Bush. We're not in the Persian Gulf War yet. Like, the world was changing, and people didn't want to talk about that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, the news at night was... we're still talking about the Iran-Contra affair. All that stuff was over. But we had troops in places. You know, you had the thing with the quote-unquote real Top Gun. Remember when the pilots ran into the MiGs and they got shot at and stuff? Like, the real stuff was happening. Like, the news would report that. And they were like, well, we'll show you footage. And they have to edit out every other word because it's all swearing. And it's like... oh my God, like, that's really happening? But that wasn't happening here.
Yeah, I know. Remember, in our life, in the early 1990s, it was, you're in school, you're playing basketball, you're playing football, you got, then you started high school, and it was, our lives were centered around home.
Yeah, right. Well, I'm saying, it wasn't like I had, the world view and the world political views that are occurring, I was too young, and you guys were old enough to have not. You know, it wasn't like it wasn't. We were bookending the people who really. Oh my God, how can this happen? And I'm not saying I didn't want. You know, that I'm in favor of any of that stuff, but it just wasn't my world.
Right. No, your world revolved around school and sports.
Right. And that's the problem is movies like this sometimes do fall through the cracks there, and I think this is one of the reasons why. Again, I know we had talked about different movies and what we could pick and what could go here. I mean, we talked about The Day the Earth Stood Still as one of the movies to possibly go here, which is a classic, classic movie, and I love that movie. And, you know, even though Gort's pants kind of bend, but, you know, kind of thing. But that movie had a political statement to make also, very different than this one. But that statement was, hey, you better stop killing each other. Wars are not the answer. But that was a much more, stop doing this. And he's saying the same thing. Look at what he's showing it to you. Sometimes it's hard to see things until someone holds a mirror up to it. And I think he was trying to do that here. I just don't think it reached enough people because it just was limited in what it is.
Yeah.
And again, a lot of people think of this movie, they only think of it, it's about that killer robot, and they dismiss it. This isn't Chopping Mall, right? Which is another movie I had considered for this, because Chopping Mall is about killer robots, and that movie is about killer robots. But that's part of what it is. And, you know... We've hit all around all this stuff here. We talked about the different aspects of this film, and I think a lot of times people maybe have never seen it, you know. And I think this is different than, let's say, the Abominable Snowman in the Himalayas was lost. Abominable Himalayas is hard to get your hands on. This movie, if you really want to see it, there's the 2-disc DVD that Dad and I were talking about. That's what we watched it on. That's $14.95 on Amazon. Right, and the single disc, they actually put a one disc out of it. Now, that was Severin thinking ahead. They put a single disc just of the movie, just the first disc, and that's $7.99. The Blu-ray is impossible to get. It is backordered everywhere. I mean, I'm sure Severin Films, you can get it from them, but again, if you're interested in checking this movie out, folks, and Again, I think it's worth your time and effort. Go to the Amazon, go to Two True Freaks, hit that Amazon link. You can check it out there. I would definitely make sure, if you have an old bootleg copy of it, because that was the original one we had, that old dark bootleg. This movie's hard to see. It's not a lot of light. And then when you put a dark copy, like a fourth generation copy, you're like, what is going on in this scene? I feel like, what movie was I talking to Luke about? Where I finally saw it, I'm like, oh, that's what's in that scene? Like there's people in here? Like, you know, so. But anyway, so I think we've, you know, covered this pretty well. Is there anything else?
Yeah, one thing I'd like to say is that, I mean, this is a movie that if you had not suggested it, I would not have pulled it out of my library. Mm-hmm. I'm glad I did, because it gave us a lot to talk about. It is something that is controversial, and I must say this: will I ever watch it again? I don't know. I'm sure it's not going to come up on Turner Classic Movies.
No.
and if it comes up on the Sci-Fi Channel, it's going to be cut to ribbons.
Yeah, yeah.
So
more than it already is. So.
Yeah, I mean, but in the end, was it worth my time? Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, fun. It's not a fun movie. I think that's the problem. Sometimes, and people don't understand this. When I say to somebody, like, "Oh man, I was watching Friday the 13th Part 7. What a fun movie!" And they're like, "Fun movie? People die." I'm like, "Yeah, I know. It's a lot of fun. Like, because it's
a lot of it is tongue in cheek,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, well, but I'm saying, but you're not sitting there going, "Oh, what statement is Jason Voorhees making here when he slams the machete into her skull?" That's a different movie, but still, it's like, you know, like, what's he making? What political statement is he making? He's not making any statement. He's a force of nature killing people. It, you know, that you don't sit down to watch this as like. Hey, this is fun. Let's sit and watch a movie. Like, this is a movie that kind of is on, and you sit down. You don't just catch this. You put this on, and I think sometimes that's people. If it's not a movie that, like, they don't have a fun memory about it. Like, it's just kind of like, you know, it sits there. And I think one of the issues, and I said this movie reminds me of The Crow because of the music. The Crow is a movie that where Brandon Lee obviously died making it, and I mean, I love The Crow, and I've watched that movie, you know, dozens of times. But that movie is not a fun movie either, but it has a more upbeat ending. This doesn't have that upbeat ending. Yes, they killed the Mark 13 in the shower, but the Mark 13 is going into production. And what does he say? It's not going to be some bill that sterilizes us. She says it's going to be these machines that sterilize us. And it's true.
The end of the world is inescapable.
Yeah. Well, so with that being said, I'll talk about what's coming up next. So next, we're going back to that year we love, 1957, yes, and this time we're going to a movie that my dad loves, The Land Unknown.
Oh, yes.
The Land Unknown. For those of you who have not figured it out yet, we don't like remakes most of the time, but The Land Unknown, if you have ever seen it, you would understand why a big budget remake of this movie would be kick, you know what,
yes.
You know, kind of thing. Because The Land Unknown is funny. Just, and I know I don't want to get ahead of ourselves here, but Land Unknown, when we actually had MeTV, it was on Svengoolie, and Haley's watching. Haley loves I love Svengoolie too. It's on Svengoolie, and we're watching this, and Haley goes, "What's this movie?" I go, "This is one of Grandpa's favorite movies." And I go, "Remember this model?" And we talked about the model outside.
Right. Like,
oh, and she's trying so hard to stay awake because, you know, she's little. So, and she sees them. She goes, "Okay, Dad." I'm like, "Trust me, it's gonna be good." She goes, "They're flying in a helicopter. Like, they got to get there. Like, you know, her like such." Why does Grandpa like this? This isn't King Kong. This isn't whatever. And I said, "You'll understand." And we recorded it, and we watched the Svengoolie the next day. And she's like, "This is good." And she likes it because it's fun. And again, this is a movie that, not making a political statement, you know, The Land Unknown is a good movie. And I think a lot of people may have missed this one too, because they kind of write it off as being cheesy. But that's another story for another day. So, again, folks, we love to hear from you. If you have any feedback about Hardware, maybe you're a little older than I am. Maybe you're in your, you know, your 40s and stuff. Maybe you were in college when this came out, and it's a movie that maybe made a statement to you. Or maybe, you know, you had a friend or a girlfriend or somebody who was, like, really into, like, you know, I'm going to fight the power, political power and whatever. And this was one of the movies, like, hey, well, this movie has a statement to it, you know, kind of thing. And you know, we'll love to hear from you if... any kind of feedback would be great. So keep those cards and letters coming, and keep watching the skies.
This is Tokyo, once a city of 6 million people. What has happened here was caused by a force which, up until a few days ago, was entirely beyond the scope of man's imagination. Tokyo, a smoldering memorial to the unknown. An unknown which at this very moment still prevails and could at any time lash out with its terrible destruction anywhere else in the world.
Hi, folks. Luke Giaconetti here. I'd like to ask you a few questions. Do you like giant monsters? Or as they're called in Japan, Daikaiju? Monsters like Godzilla, Rodan, Gamera, King Ghidorah, or Mothra? Do you like more obscure monsters, such as Gappa or Yangari? Do you like giant heroes like Ultraman or super robots like the Shogun Warriors? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then I think you might like my podcast, Earth Destruction Directive. I'm a dedicated fan of all things Daikaiju, and I'd like to share that with all of you. Please check out Earth Destruction Directive at twotruefreaks.com. Earth Destruction Directive, where we turn your Daikaiju dreams into city-smashing reality.
This has been an episode of Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-Movie Podcast. If you'd like to contact me, please email the show at botsbugsbabes@gmail.com. If you'd like to find me online, I'm on Facebook under my name, Jason Giaconetti. I often contribute to the Two True Freaks Facebook group. You can visit my Facebook page, The Art of Horror Collective, and you can search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective. On Instagram, find me under my name, Jason Giaconetti, and search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective, as well as the new hashtag Bots Bugs Babes Podcast. I'm the only one using them. I'm also on Twitter at Jason Giaconetti, and you can visit my webpage at www.theartofhorrorcollective.wordpress.com. All movies, characters, stories, music, etc. are properties of their respective holders. This is a fan work, and any use of any property is purely for review, discussion, entertainment. So don't sue me. I ain't got anything anyway.
There is no tomorrow! There is no tomorrow! There is no tomorrow!
Will you stop?